Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this month's Hancock & Whitney Bank Economic Update Call. Hancock Bank and Whitney Bank provide this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or its affiliates. If you have any questions during the call, please email them to jeffrey.tangus@whitneybank.com. That's jeffrey.tangus. TANGUIS@whitneybank.com, and we will take those at the end of the call. Today I have Chief Investment Officer John Fortwood, Investment Directors Greg Hudlisky, Luther McDougall, and Jeff Tangus. Jeff Tangus is going to be the moderator today, and with that I'll pass the call on to him.
Thank you, Ashley, and good morning, everyone. Welcome to our monthly economic call. I would also point out for those of you with questions, my first name is spelled J-E-F-F-E-R-Y. Tangus@whitneybank.com. Well, we've had a lot that's taken place over the last month, so let's jump right in with John Fortwood. John, the global attention shifted back to Europe this past month. Since we last spoke, the small nation of Cyprus was forced to seek a bailout. Can you give us a little background on the situation and what the overall impact is, and if there are any other countries that we should be concerned about?
Okay, everybody may have followed the news enough to know what Cyprus is all about, but just in case they haven't, Cyprus is a small island in the eastern Mediterranean near the coast of Turkey. Half of the island is Muslim due to a war. An invasion from Turkey maybe 30, 40, 50 years ago, sometime back. And the other half is Christian and somewhat, you know, tied to Greece. Anyway, the country's GDP accounts for about 0.2% of all the GDP, you know, produced every year in the Eurozone. But the banks, serving as sort of a depository for Russian oligarchs, so they say, and perhaps some, you know, laundered money of one kind or another, and really offshore money, I guess, grew to be about seven times the size of the country's GDP. A lot of the banks invested in Greece and bought Greek bonds, and to just simplify things, people that own Greek bonds took a haircut when Greece was, you know, bailed out the first time by the EU, and that put those banks in serious difficulty, and it sort of crept up as a surprise to a lot of us, I think, because even though we read about Greece, about Cyprus, and the difficulties that the banks were having there, say several years ago, it sort of faded into the background until things came to a head recently. And here's what happened: the Eurozone officials told Cyprus, "We'll bail out your banks to save the country from total collapse and give you about $10 billion, but that's all you're going to get, and you've got to figure out a way to get the money internally." So with the help, I guess, and the consultation of the European Union officials, Cyprus decided to attach bank deposits, what's called a bail-in. Cyprus is getting a bailout, but they're bailing in depositors to help pay for this. So in the first go-around, they said, we'll tax everybody's deposits. We'll seize some money from depositors who have less than 100,000 euro, which there is an implicit, guarantee in the Eurozone that if you have less than 100,000 or less on deposit, that your money is safe. We'll tax you about 6 or 7%, and for people that have over 100,000 euro, in the banks, we'll tax them at about 10%. Well, that really opened Pandora's box as far as, you know, the so-called guarantee of 100,000 euro that's fairly safe throughout the Eurozone, and created the possibility of bank runs and all sorts of things all over Europe, not just in Cyprus. So they decided to change that and take that off the table. Obviously, taking that off the table is like trying to wipe up spilled milk. It's already been spilled. It's already done some damage, and that's going to have long-term repercussions probably throughout the Eurozone. But as things stand now, Cyprus has introduced capital controls. Only a certain amount of money can leave the country at any one time. Individuals can only withdraw, I think, about 300 euros per day from the ATMs, and the capital controls may stay in place for some time as they figure out how much of the deposits above 100,000 euros they're going to take. According to the information we saw yesterday, it looks like people who have more than 100,000 euro deposited in a bank in Cyprus may lose as much as 80% of it. And there's also information out there to the effect that a lot of people sort of front ran, I guess if you want to call it, did a little front running and got money out of the banks, not only just before the decision was made about what to do with the deposits, but perhaps even afterwards. We hear that there's a branch of one of these banks in England that kept giving out money all through the so-called shutdown period when the controls were put in place. So we still don't know, I don't think at this point, how much money is available and whether or not it's enough to really save Cyprus. And there was a guy being interviewed the other day, an economist from Denmark, who is considered an expert in these matters, and he said he didn't think the story about Cyprus was over and that there probably would be another shoe to drop, and that even after, you know, this process is completed, the country probably will still be in trouble, and it will be, you know, increasingly difficult to keep Cyprus in the Eurozone, which, of course, might have implications for other countries as well. I guess, you know, we've talked about this crisis in the Eurozone for a long time, and it seems to be never-ending. I guess there might be good news and bad news in this situation with Cyprus. The good news is, I suppose, that it accelerates the Eurozone crisis towards some sort of solution, because it looks like things are going to be sped up a little bit because of this, and maybe, you know, create, you know, enough concern for the Eurozone to move towards some sort of political and banking union, which almost seems impossible. The bad news, of course, if things have been sped up, is we don't know what the solution is going to be. You know, the solution could be a complete breakup of the euro, and it could be a pretty messy affair. And at this point, we don't really know exactly, you know, how that's going to work out. We also see, I mean, obviously Cyprus is going into a pretty chaotic period. We've seen news reports of people trying to flee across the border with a couple of hundred thousand, you know, euro in a suitcase or a bag, and they have been, you know, caught at the border and the money confiscated. So, you know, obviously none of this creates an atmosphere of trust or stability throughout the Eurozone, and people expect large depositors to be carefully selecting the banks they're going to use for business transactions, because you can imagine if you're a businessman and you have a business transaction that clears through a bank in Europe, you probably don't want it to clear on a Friday or have the money sit there on a Friday and be there over the weekend, because you can't trust that it won't be, you know, confiscated in some fashion, assuming, you know, one or more of these countries blows up. So it's really a difficult situation, and we don't exactly know how it's going to play out. But, you know, bottom line, credit growth in Europe is practically nil at this point. They're still in recession, probably will be in recession most of the year. Germany is teetering on the edge of recession because of what's happening in the peripheral countries. So, you know, the faster something is done to resolve this issue, the better off the Europeans are going to be, and the better off, you know, all of us will be from the standpoint of risk. And this is kind of what you call one of those ambiguous risks. You know, you know there's a risk there, but how it's going to be resolved is completely, you know, uncertain. So we'll just have to live with it for a while and see what happens. So far, they've been able to contain the problem. But, you know, at best, you know, we're looking at slow growth, and banks struggling to, you know, raise capital and, you know, become more, you know, less risk prone, I guess, for a good while. And at worst, you know, you could have a, you know, a messy situation where, you know, some banks or some countries leave the euro, and you have some financial disruption as that happens. By the way, The next country on the list is apparently Slovenia. They don't have a banking problem like Cyprus. Apparently Slovenia, by the way, which is kind of, where is it? Somewhere on the border with Austria, kind of north of Italy, on the border with Austria, I think, you know, one of the Baltic countries. Anyway, Slovenia has a problem, and they just don't have any money. I mean, I think it's kind of a system-wide problem in Slovenia. And then you have people talk about Malta as being next in line, and the other interesting problem with banking in Europe, the banks in Europe are much, much larger in these countries than any of our banks, and they represent, you know, 7-8 times GDP, particularly in the case of Liechtenstein and Luxembourg, for example. You know, French and German banks are awfully quite large in terms of, you know, their relationship to the individual countries. So, you know, the banking system over there, it makes the countries much more vulnerable than, you know, we would be here if we were if some of our banks were having similar problems. But in any case, that's kind of what's happening. Slovenia looks like the next one in line. Somebody decided that it would be a good idea that we talk about the pigs, the ones that are having trouble, the Portugal, Ireland, Greece, and Spain. You need to add an S to it and put Slovenia, because Slovenia is probably the next in line. You know, we've been dealing with this for a long time. It looks like it's going to be with us for some time to come, but with what's happened in Cyprus, it would appear that we're probably accelerating towards some sort of resolution, and we'll just have to see what it is. I might mention, too, that, of course, we all, you know, this adds some, you know, some risk to the, you know, international investment picture, but you've got Iran and North Korea, of course, being geopolitical risks. Japan and China are in continuous conflict, verbal conflict, and at this point over some small islands in the South China Sea. So, you know, to some degree, what we're going through now is similar to what we had in the 1970s, just a little bit different, which, again, is fairly typical to these kinds of you know, economic periods that are filled with disturbances and imbalances, and you know, that's sort of where we are. I talked about a lot of different things, Jeff, and in addition to Cyprus, but I guess Cyprus is sort of the poster child, if you will, for what's happening in Europe at the present time, and we'll just have to pay a lot of attention and see how it goes.
Well, Cyprus certainly was the focus of attention, but also another country that's had a lot of attention focused on it lately is Japan, which after maybe a 20-something year slumber here, it looks like the Japanese economy is finally starting to wake up due to something they call Abenomics, which I'm looking forward to hearing you explain. The Nikkei is up about 15% so far for this year, so good things must be happening in Japan. What's the story there?
Well, the newer Japanese government in Japan has had a lot of changes in government over time, but the new Japanese government has decided to try to break the cycle of deflation that they've been in for the past 20 years and create inflation and perhaps create some more growth internally. And they've decided to use, you know, Mario Draghi's words, you know, about what's going to happen in the Eurozone. You know, we're going to do whatever it takes to get Japan out of this funk. And so far, it's had more impact on the Japanese stock market than it has on the Japanese economy. And I guess we'll have to, you know, see how effectiveness, you know, what this the effectiveness of this new policy will be in Japan for the long term. But, you know, Japan has an incredibly older society, and it's rapidly aging. And Japan used to be, they used to have a lot of savers in the country, so the Japanese savers were prone to buy Japanese bonds, and so even though the Japanese government did spend a lot of money and issue a lot of bonds to try to, you know, generate some economic growth over time, it generally failed. They tried a certain amount of stimulus, and it failed. And along the way, their interest rates stayed low because all these Japanese that had not yet hit retirement age were saving a lot of money, as they always have, and buying Japanese government bonds with the money. Well, now, with the Japanese population aging so rapidly, those people are not buying the bonds anymore. They're using the bonds to live on. They're spending the money, cashing in some of the bonds and certainly not saving the way they were. And so Japan more and more is going to have to depend on outside money to fund the government. The public debt to GDP, government debt to GDP, I believe the last time I looked, is about 250%. And, extremely high creates a very unstable environment for Japan. And there are people who think of Japan as a bug in search of a windshield if they don't get their act together. The threat being, at some point, if they have to sell their bonds, if they can't sell any bonds internally and they have to sell the bonds to outsiders, if outsiders demand a higher interest rate, then, then it's curtains for the Japanese economy. Now, we don't know whether it's going to work out that way or not. It may be that with what the government is trying to do now, they actually, they might actually be successful. But Japan's situation really with debt, again, outlines what's wrong with most of the developed world. Too much debt built up over a period of 30 to 40 years. It looks like it's going to be awfully difficult to grow out of it. And just to throw something out there for interest, and we don't know whether these folks are any more right in their theories about what might happen than anyone else, but the Boston Consulting Group a couple of years ago produced a white paper suggesting that the only way out of this debt problem was for all the governments in the world to coordinate a a bail-in, where you write off all the debt, you confiscate financial assets from people that can afford to pay, and you just wipe the slate clean and start all over. It was a multi-page research paper that went into quite some detail about how this could be done, but obviously the likelihood of that happening is probably pretty remote unless the politicians get really desperate and realize that somebody somewhere has to take the loss. But in the case of Cyprus, for example, the Germans, who were pushing for that quite hard, decided that the German taxpayer ultimately might be on the hook for all this. We don't want to be on the hook for it. Somebody else has to take the hit, and maybe bailing in, as they say, is the thing to do. And some other Eurozone politicians have said the same thing. Even after this Cyprus thing, turned out to be something of a fiasco at first with what they planned to do initially, some EU officials said, well, maybe this is the template for the future. Again, it gets back to, what might happen in Europe now if you're a large depositor and you're trying to, safeguard your assets. So again, we're moving down the road, I guess, to some solution to some of these problems in the world. We just don't know exactly, how these solutions are going to work out.
Well, moving the conversation to back to the United States here at home, let's talk a little bit about our economy, and certainly our stock market has done well so far for this year. But in recent history, since about 2010, our economy has typically done well in the first quarter and then hit a soft patch in the summertime. This year, things are playing out more or less the same way, which means we had a pretty good first quarter. Can you tell us about some of the things that went right in the first quarter? We had a lot of concerns because of sequestration, the fiscal cliff, lots of things that were supposed to impact the first quarter. And in spite of all that, we've had a really nice first quarter in terms of the stock market. Can you talk economically about what's taking place in the first quarter and then what you see going forward?
Real final demand in the first quarter turned out to be a little better than anyone thought until about the middle of the quarter. Guesses were that the quarter would be, say, 1.5%, 2% GDP. The fourth quarter of last year was 0.4. The last, estimate came out plus 0.4. And then a couple of weeks ago, given what was happening to various coincident indicators that were suggesting the economy might be picking up a little steam in this quarter, the estimates for GDP for this quarter went to about 3% fairly quickly. Then, based on some data that came out 2 days ago, some of the estimates are, well, whoops, we're back to 1.5 again. So it looks like it's going to be kind of a confused quarter. It's going to be certainly better than, you know, the fourth quarter of last year. But, you know, most of the coincident indicators that we look at suggest that we're tracking along at an above potential rate, and the consensus among economists now is that growth potential is probably around 2.5%. So, you know, you can look at what's happening to the coincident data and say, well, you know, it could be at least a 2.5% quarter, but anyway, it's certainly going to be a lot better than what happened last year. The sequestration issue, the hit to GDP that everybody thought would probably be felt in the first quarter by, you know, the various agreements and tax changes that occurred, you know, at the beginning of the year, haven't really shown up yet. Although some information I have seen relative to what's happening online purchases of discretionary goods, suggests that consumer spending online is beginning to fall off fairly rapidly. So, you know, again, it could be that the first, you know, two quarters of this year are relatively slow, as they have been in the past. And something else interesting is happening, and I don't really at this point know exactly what to make of this, but some economists are suggesting, and apparently Bernanke has indicated such in some speeches, that the crash in 2008 was so severe that a lot of the economic data produced by the government on a seasonally adjusted basis is kind of messed up. And that may be, to some degree, why you're seeing these odd GDP cycles for the last couple of years, that, you know, the underlying trend is probably positive, but it could be that the economy is not really fluctuating as much from quarter to quarter as some of the data suggests. So, you know, we'll just have to see how that works out. But anyway, it looks like, you know, we're not in a recessionary environment. The level of activity is very, very low. You know, right now, through the last quarter, since the recovery that began in 2009, the GDP rate of growth is about 1.7%, which is probably half to one-third of what it should be for that time period. So again, it gets back to that suggestion we've talked about for quite some time that, you know, our trend line growth right now is probably closer to 2% than 3%. And, you know, we may be in that mode for quite some time, indicating that the escape velocity or the liftoff to a 3% plus consistent GDP growth rate is probably sometime in the future. And, you know, if some of the long-term forecasters are correct, you know, it may be a number of years into the future before we see any kind of consistent GDP growth like that. So we'll just have to see, you know, how that works out. But at least so far this year, you know, economic growth seems to be okay, and the leading indicators suggest, you know, we're not on the cusp of recession.
Well, I'll take that as good news. Luther, are you there?
I'm here.
Great. Can you give us an update on the Fed and interest rates and what you see going on in that world?
Well, during the first quarter of this year, we've pretty much continued on the same roller coaster ride we've been on since July of last year. That is, rates spiking up on any news of economic activity on the positive side, and then rates being pulled down by the risk-off trade as the news from Europe, particularly Cyprus in the first quarter, brings interest rates down as you have the flight to quality to the U.S. Treasury market. We started the year on the 10-year U.S. Treasury at 1.75%. And as the news came out, as John mentioned earlier, of better economic growth in the first quarter, we actually got the 10-year Treasury up to over 2% to 2.05%. and that was in the first 2 weeks of March. After that, we started to hear the news of Cyprus and that they would need a bail-in, bail-out, whatever term you'd like to use, and the rate dropped from 2.05 down to 1.84. So for the first quarter, we saw rates go from up about 10 basis points, which is the same kind of trend we've seen, like I said, since July of last year when rates bottomed out at around 1.4% on the 10-year. So it looks like overall the economy is continuing to be strong enough to slowly move interest rates up. We're not having the big trade that everybody expected with a rotation out of bonds. What we've seen more is a rotation from longer bonds to shorter-term bonds, maybe even to a certain extent flattening the yield curve a little bit. The most recent news out of the Fed has come in regards to how are we going to get out of this mess eventually. Right now, the Fed is still purchasing $85 billion every month in the open market. And originally, the first step in that would be to slowly cut back on the purchases and then to slowly begin to sell what the Fed has on its books, which is a very, very large amount of bonds. Now, the most recent comments from Bernanke are that, well, you know, maybe after we stop buying bonds, we don't really have to sell any of the bonds. We can just slowly let them mature and roll off our books. Which to me says that the Fed is ever more, the probability is very, very high that rates are going to stay low for a long period of time because the Fed is just saying we don't see anything out there. Even if we do stop purchases to maybe shake out a little bit of the excesses in the market, you're not going to see a lot of sales from the Fed. And that should keep interest rates low for a long period of time. But overall, we're still on a slightly upward trend in interest rates as reflected by the Treasury that we've been in for the past 9 months. For the first quarter, the best performing sectors were corporates and taxable municipal bonds, as you can imagine, because they have higher coupons or yields of maturities than comparable Treasuries agencies. Which is kind of where we were positioned, but we'll have to see how things go going forward. But it's pretty much been the same old story over the first quarter as it was over the last two quarters of 2012.
Well, thank you for that update. Greg, are you on the line?
Yeah, good morning, Jeff.
Good morning. As I mentioned earlier, the stock market really has had a nice run both so far for the year and also for the last month or so. It looks like stocks are up about 10% for the first quarter. What's driving the rally, and will it continue?
Well, I think some of it is probably as a result of the Fed, a liquidity-driven market. If you look at some of the money flows into the S&P 500 ETF, you're seeing a pretty large chunk of money coming from institutional buyers. So there's money going into stocks, not so much on the retail side. We're also seeing the VIX, or the volatility index, continues to decline, which tends to be a positive thing psychologically. You know, less bouncing around makes people more comfortable. But I think, again, it's probably more the institutional side that we're seeing those fund flows coming into stocks. If you look at kind of a balance sheet, the positives, home prices continue to improve. And that's a big chunk of the economy. So we had some weakness in the February sales number in new homes and pending sales. They slipped in that month. But basically, the year-over-year growth in pricing is still solid. Looking at capital expenditures again, which would be an indication of business confidence, they're on the rise. So core cap goods rose at a 31% annualized rate, up from 20% in the fourth quarter of 2012. So that's a big positive in that, and I think we've talked previously on the call that perhaps all the cash on the sideline would begin to be put to use this year, and that may be an indication that we could have a pretty good second half. And again, valuations, if you look at the forward P.E., it's about 13.7 times, so it's not deep cheap, but historically it's relatively cheap. It's right around the long-term historical PE average. On the negative side, some of the more regional economic surveys do suggest the slowing. So the soft patch that you had talked about earlier, we could be entering into a period where things do slow down a bit. We did get a fourth quarter revision of GDP, which John mentioned. It actually got bumped up slightly from 0.1% to 0.4%, but it was actually less than expected. I think the market was expecting a 0.5. And consumer spending was revised downward, which, again, is a huge component of GDP. That was revised down from 2.1% to 1.8%. But bottom line, you know, we've had a year's worth of stock returns in 3 months. I'd have a pretty hard time arguing that we're not going to have some kind of a pullback here. And, you know, Europe may be the trigger or the catalyst again, but it just wouldn't surprise me at this point. But longer term, yeah, I think there's still enough positives to keep this market going up just in the short term, which, again, are incredibly hard to predict, short-term moves in the stock market. But, again, it wouldn't surprise me if we give up some of that 10% over the coming months.
Yeah. Thanks, Greg. And we're running real short on time. We have one quick question. I'll throw it out to Luther because I think it's a timely thing, and we haven't really touched on muni bonds. But we had a question come in about Stockton, California, and the impending bankruptcy. I hear that a federal judge has approved Stockton filing for bankruptcy. Can you talk real quickly about the municipal? Has that had an impact on the municipal market, and what you see if, as a trend there?
Yeah, the Stockton, California case is a little bit unusual in that a lot of individuals thought they would not be allowed to file for Chapter 9. So the concern is that this will open the door for many other cities that are in the same circumstance to do the same thing. And you know, to a certain extent, it might be helpful because it allows them to renegotiate some of the ridiculous terms they have in their unfunded pension liabilities. It's going to affect all of the municipal market, but as has happened in the past, typically this type of event is much more regional in nature in that it will affect California more so than any other state. We saw the same thing happen with all of the concerns in Alabama, where it really affected Birmingham and its ability to issue bonds. But on a national basis, it's more of a hiccup than anything else.
Great. Thank you. And that's about all the time we have today. We want to thank everybody for tuning in. We look forward to speaking with you again next month, and look forward to all of John and Luther and Greg's comments. And I think Dave Lundgren will be joining us again next month. So thank you all for attending today, and we'll see you next month.